Just I'm gonna give a few brief introductory slides. So I'm gonna basically be talking about the evolution of transcription factors, and I would argue that most of what's known about the evolution of transcription factor function has been learned by studying HOX proteins, which are proteins that control what kind of morphologies you develop on the anterior-posterior axis of developing animal embryos. They do other things, but this is their ancient and conserved function as a system. So this was originally learned about by mutations that gave dramatic transformations of the body plan, so-called homeotic mutations. And Ed Lewis found a long time ago that if you mutate some regulatory elements in the ultrabithorax HOX gene so that you remove the adult functions from certain regions of the imaginal discs of the fly, you can transform a fly from a two-winged fly, a dipteran, into a four-winged fly. So there weren't a lot of these kinds of flies that Ed was ever able to create, but this was a removal of the function. You get a complete duplication of the second thoracic segment. And you transform this little balancing organ here and this tiny little third thoracic segment into a copy of the second thoracic segment. So you get two of those.
Could that thing fly on the right?
It can't fly. No, all the muscles aren't transformed, so. Excuse me? No, in this particular one, there's actually three mutations in three separate cis-regulatory elements of the UBX gene. So if you eliminate the function of this gene, you die as an embryo that has some segmental malformations, but only this one removes adult functions of that protein.
Was this discovered by accident, or was there some logic to?
The original mutations in the ultrabithorax gene were discovered by accident, but you know, Ed Lewis, who won the Nobel Prize in 1995, did a very systematic mutagenesis of this gene and two other nearby homeotic genes, and found a lot of mutations in these genes, and including these. Other questions? So another example of one of these dramatic malformations is when you ectopically express another HOX protein called antennapedia. Lewis showed this on the first morning. So normally, a fruit fly has a small antenna on its the anterior head, consisting of a few segments. And if you have mutations where the antennapedia protein is ectopically expressed in those cells, in those developing cells, you transform them into a second pair, an additional pair of thoracic legs. So normal thoracic legs down here, and you develop this large extra leg or pair of extra legs. I'm gonna argue a little bit later that's not actually a very surprising result, given what we know now about homeotic genes. Anyway, so in flies, there's these two complexes of homeotic genes, ultrabithorax, that one gene I talked about, and antennapedia, and adjacent to them are these other homeotic or HOX genes that all have similar roles in patterning the anterior-posterior body axis of fruit flies. And the reason why this gene complex is interesting, or one major reason it's interesting, is that it's not only present in the fly genome as a gene complex or two nearby gene complexes, but there's also four gene complexes very similar to this single gene complex in flies, in mammals, and both mice and humans. And a lot of work over the past 20 years or so has shown that, in general, the proteins encoded by these HOX genes in mice and humans have similar effects in patterning parts of the main body axis, anterior-posterior body axis, as well as having roles in development of the limbs, patterning different aspects of limb development. So it's an ancient system that existed in a bilateral metazoan that existed somewhere between 600 million years ago and 1 billion years ago, and has been conserved for anterior-posterior patterning since then. Yeah.
And there are homologies between HOX1 and HOX2.
Yeah, all these encode homeodomain proteins that are related to each other in sequence, particularly in the DNA binding domain. But these have some similarities to each other, as I'll say, but deform, for example, when you compare it to HOXA4, B4, C4, D4, is very clearly a homolog or orthologue. So it's much more closely related to the A4 or the four class of genes than it is to antennapedia or proboscipedia. So clearly this complex was present in these early bilateral metazoans. So one of the principles about the Hox genes, they're expressed in zones. So a lot of their informational content is actually by where they're expressed in the developing body plan. So this is a deformed. And this is one of those blastoderm embryos that you've seen so many pictures of so far. And deformed is expressed in a stripe of six cells on the anterior posterior axis. These cells are fated to become the maxillary and mandibular segments. And in a Drosophila maggot, they eventually give rise to certain parts of the head skeleton, certain sensory organs, and so forth. And deformed provides a lot of the information that distinguishes their shape and form and function from other regions on the anterior posterior body axis. Deformed is the name of the gene. It was also originally isolated by accident because dominant mutations in deformed had deformed heads.
And that is a Hox gene?
That's a Hox gene, yeah.
Was that on the original?
Yeah, it was on the original one. It's that's quite all right.
Sorry. It's the most important one.
It's by far the most important.
Oh, there's deformed, I'm sorry.
There's deformed, right?
And it's conservation of all the other creatures. It's in all forms.
Amazing. That means it's the most important.
I apologize.
So, the very simplified version of Hox proteins, they encode transcription factors that have this signature homeodomain, that 60 amino acid region, that is very similar among different Hox proteins, although not perfectly conserved. And a lot of the information that gives them specific functions is encoded in the small differences of this DNA binding domain in different, head versus thorax versus abdominal proteins. So a lot of work has shown, for the past 50 years that Hox genes are required to diversify morphology during animal development. So we and a lot of other peoples have been asking the question, what kinds of mutations in Hox genes have diversified morphology during evolution? Is that one place where you have mutations that diversify morphology? So this original bilateral metazoan from a variety of molecular and...
That's my forebear.
This is what gave rise to Mike Levine. After a few mutations in the Hox genes. Yeah, it does have some pattern from head to tail. You have some head segments here that are different than. Yeah, I haven't put all that into this particular animal, but there is some morphological differences here. This is to show that there's a lot of conserved genes, systems like visceral mesoderm, heart, eye, muscle, determining genes. They're all conserved in animals from this original guy. Anyway, so this animal gave rise to a wide diversity of animal forms, and many of which have different morphologies on their anterior-posterior axes. And could changes in Hox genes and proteins have anything to do with that? So almost much of the work addressing this question has taken place in the study of arthropod evolution. So arthropods are these animals with multi-jointed limbs, which include spiders, insects, crustaceans, millipedes, centipedes, and extinct trilobites. And these are believed to, there's a lot of evidence that these evolved from a multi-limbed pre-arthropod precursor. And in the process of diversifying into millipedes, crustaceans, insects, you changed limb number quite a few times. And so this is a clear, simple kind of morphological distinction. You have a limb or you don't have a limb, or the limbs have different morphology. It's known to be controlled in flies by the homeotic genes. And so it's been used as a marker for evolutionary change. And so something that's known in Drosophila about limb development, there's a gene called distalus, which was isolated because of its effects on the distal limb development. And distalus promotes limbs in fly embryos, appendages really, but including the primordia for the three walking legs in flies. So you can see three appendage primordia, that's where distalus is expressed in the trunk, but distalus is not expressed in the rest of the a germ band, so the first abdominal segment and all the way back to the posterior abdomen. However, two Hox genes, UBX, that one I talked about, and abdominal A, repress distalis and limbs in the abdomen of fruit fly embryos in adults. So if you mutate both of these genes, both of these Hox genes, you get the limb primordia and embryonic limbs made throughout the entire trunk. And not only that, they have the power, when they're ectopically expressed, to repress distalis and limbs. So here you look in the thorax of this Drosophila embryo. If you turn on UBX or abdominal A in this region, you repress distalis and you don't develop limbs. So in flies, there's a clear correlation there. And actually, Steve Cohen, a long time ago, characterized a regulatory element from distalis, an 877 nucleotide fragment, that would provide expression in those limb primordia, and found that it was directly regulated by ultrabithorax protein. So how can Hox mutations change? So there's been a lot of study from Sean Carroll's lab, Nipam Patel's lab, and other labs that has shown that you can make a strong case that cis-regulatory mutations, or the distribution of some transacting factor that regulate the Hox genes themselves, has changed during evolution. So you've had some mutations there. Because what you see is a correlation between changes in either the presence, absence of limbs, or the modified forms of limbs, and the expression pattern of Hox proteins. So here's an example. This is a butterfly larva. And so it has three pairs of walking legs. And it also has these appendages, leg-like appendages, developing from the abdominal segments 3, 4, 5, and 6. And when you look at distalis expression in an embryo that's going to give rise to this butterfly larva, butterflies, the adult form, don't have limbs. Only the larval form of butterflies have these abdominal limbs. And this is thought to be a derived condition. That is, it's thought that the ancestor of the butterflies had removed all the limbs from its abdomen, and somehow butterflies then were able to have limbs develop for whatever selective purpose in the abdomen. And when you look at distalis expression, you see this high levels of expression in the what's going to be the three thoracic legs. And you also see tiny spots of distalis expression in these four abdominal segments. And what Warren and Carroll and others found is that when you look at the distribution of ultrabithorax and abdominal A protein, you can see they stain throughout the abdomen, as they do in Drosophila. Those proteins are present. But in the regions where distalis is going to be coming on in these segments, you see a zone where the ultrabithorax and abdominal A proteins are not expressed. So the thought is that there's been mutations at the genes for UBX abdominal A that have allowed those genes to be turned off in these zones of cells, allowing distalis to come on and the promotion of legs. Yeah. Those zones are, I don't know exactly how large they are, but they're in the range of probably, 15 to 50 cells, something like that. Any other questions? Anyway, so and based on these results and a lot of other results, there's been the speculation, idea, hypothesis that a large amount of evolutionary change has been due to cis-regulatory element mutation, and there's some of the theoretical arguments for that. So there's evidence for it, as I showed one piece of evidence, and there's other pieces of evidence. But there's been a lot written about this, and so one thing has been hypothesized that cis-regulatory element change would be easier on an animal somehow. So that you'd have tiny mutations that would change the body plan in very subtle ways. And one of the reasons why this would presumably be subtle is that you could change the expression pattern of only one gene at a time. So you're changing the expression pattern of only one gene. This may make it more likely that you could get mutations that would subtly alter morphology but allow an organism to survive and breed and so forth. Of course, this isn't true if that gene encodes a regulatory protein. So if you ectopically express, Eric thinks this argument is shoddy, or my presentation. I don't know. That's good. I want him to get agitated. And another reason why this might be a great way to do it, and there's no doubt that this occurs very, very commonly, is because of binding site redundancy. So you can imagine that cis-regulatory elements could be micro evolutionary changes. Although, as we talked about earlier in this meeting, in the case of micro changes, what is there to be selected in the environment to make these?
Yeah, because are you talking about the changes here in the upstream or in the downstream targets?
No. Well, in this case, there's evidence for good. There's some evidence for changes in downstream targets, some indirect evidence. But here I'm talking about changes in the HOX gene regulatory elements, making subtle changes in where they're expressed, which has already been shown. There's evidence for that. I showed it up there. Are you dissing Lewis or what?
I find that very hard, but at some stage...
It has happened. There's no doubt it has happened.
But I thought the major function of the HOX gene was exerted to downstream targets.
It is. It is. So you're changing, by changing the expression pattern of a HOX gene, you're changing the regulation of a lot of downstream targets that then result in slightly different morphology. That was a very common hypothesis 5 or 10 years ago, that it was going to be in the downstream genes and the downstream regulatory elements. And there's no doubt that there's some truth to that. But we don't know much about that at the moment. Yeah. There's no evidence that it's cis or trans. That was just the argument was made that it was cis, and it could well be trans, absolutely. Yeah, Eric?
The problem of changing the HOX expression pattern seems to me would be that you, because the HOX regulate so many genes, that you're not, if you wanted to make a leg, a pseudo leg coming out of the abdomen, it's an odd thing that change your HOX gene expression and change that little region of the abdomen into a pseudothorax so that you can get a leg.
Right.
It may be well what's happening, but it's an odd solution to the problem. It would be easier in principle to...
Yeah. My thoughts about that are that, and it may be easier in some ways to change the HOX system because they have a lot of redundant functions, so antennapedia and UBX and UBX and abdominal, they have a lot of common targets. So actually, when you change the expression pattern of one of them, many of the common targets may be regulated in a very similar way, but a few may change. So that's a hand-waving argument.
So again, I've got to insist, because if you remember in my introductory thing,
yes.
I said antennapedia.
Yes.
One gene.
Yes.
And you change an antenna into a leg.
Yes.
It's all downstream targets.
It's a downstream target or two, I will argue.
How do you know there's not hundreds of downstream?
Well, we don't know it's not, but I'll tell you about the experiment that says it can be simpler than that. Okay?
But maybe the problem is that in the example that you showed on the change of the expression of the HOX genes, it doesn't make much sense for God to invent a HOX gene where just make a hole and you're going to put the leg here. I mean, if you want to do that, just remove the ability of
God?
God.
Of course, talking about the New Testament God. That was invented.
I'm sorry.
I would argue the contrary, that it's easier to change the HOX gene, because what are the targets of the HOX gene? They're going to be things like pigment producing enzymes, the things that you need to do anything, be it a leg or a wing or anything. So if you mutate that, you've got to tell them throughout, whereas what you want to mutate is something upstream that coordinates multiple mechanisms.
Evolution is going to use every level that can be selected. That's just the way it works. So I would argue, so there's been one of the arguments that that cis regulatory mutation has will explain much of morphological evolution is that HOX protein function is extraordinarily highly conserved in a stringent manner. And I'm going to go over some of the experiments that and other so-called master control genes. And I'm going to argue that the evidence for that actually is pretty poor. So here's one example. This is an experiment done in my lab 10, 12 years ago or so, where a student in my lab took HOXB6, which is closely related to Drosophila antennapedia, that one that can cause the antennae to leg transformation, in the homeodomain region, but not very well conserved outside that region. He expressed it in Drosophila embryos and in the primordia for Drosophila adult structures, and found that one of the phenotypes he got was a transformation of antenna to leg, so he got an extra leg growing out of the head. However, since then, we've learned that actually, Henry Sun did some interesting experiments to show that it's sufficient to just lower the expression or repress the expression of homothorax, distalis, or spineless, or some combination of those, to get this transformation of an antenna to a leg, particularly the kinds of legs that we got and other people have seen when they ectopically express these mammalian Hox proteins in head primordia. So I would argue that you only have to regulate one or two genes to get this phenotype. Therefore, at the molecular level, this doesn't indicate stringent conservation of this factor. Now, we don't know how many genes it does regulate, but you only need to regulate one or two to get this phenotype. So that ectopic means that the antennapedia protein is usually only expressed in the second thoracic segment, but you can attach it to different promoters that will turn it on in more anterior and more posterior regions of the body, so that you've now got that protein in an inappropriate place, and you can test to see what function it has in those places. Eric?
Clarify the discussion. If you point out that these situations indicate a repression of a complex machine to build the structure, not the machine itself.
I think that's absolutely correct. That's what you're doing. Is that things more clear? Eric says it best.
Say it again. When you see things like a wing appearing or a leg appearing, it's just telling you that the function being examined is simply to repress the operation of a complex developmental machine. It does not mean that the gene being mutated is a developmental machine. In other words, the Hox gene is just shutting off.
You go to a default pathway.
A machine to make a leg, a developmental machine to make a wing. And so that's why you see this listed. You mustn't think that the Hox gene is making a leg or making
right.
a wing.
In this instance. So another thing that spectacular experiment of this sort that I would argue has also been dramatically overinterpreted, which you've heard about before, is you can take mammal PAX6. So this is a eye promoting gene and nervous system promoting gene in mammals, and you can, if you again ectopically express it in the Drosophila body plan, you can get extra Drosophila eyes, and which mimics the function of the eyeless gene, which is its fly ortholog. But it turns out, studies since then have shown, that all you need to do to induce ectopic eyes is induce pairs, either dachshund eyeless or eyes absent and cineoculus. And actually, dachshund is already expressed in other regions of the developing fly body. Any combination of those will give you ectopic compound eyes. So again, I would argue that all PAX6 has to do, and this is also an autoregulatory circuit, which eyeless is involved in the animals where PAX6 was topically expressed, the eyeless gene was still there. So I would argue all you're doing is giving a kick to the system by turning on one or two of these genes, and you get extra compound eyes. So again, at the molecular level, I would argue that this so-called dramatic conservation of eye patterning is not very impressive. And so the evidence for stringent functional conservation of these master control genes, proteins, is skimpy to non-existent. And even the rescue experiments, there have been some rescue experiments. There's also been a lot of non-rescue experiments done, but the rescue experiments got published. And even in those cases where the Drosophila engrailed was shown to rescue, to some extent, the effects of mouse EN1 mutations, I would argue what's been learned since then about the specification of the midbrain-hindbrain boundary says that, again, all you have to do is regulate one gene, or but you can explain the phenotype, the phenotypic rescue, by the regulation of one gene, which persistently starts an autoregulatory circuit that then can explain that phenotype.
But why do you claim this is not conservation?
It is conservation of the regulation of one or two genes.
So it's fine. I mean, to regulate the gene is not that easy.
It's not that easy.
So I think it's conserved. I don't see why you argue against it.
I would say there is some general conservation. But the evidence that it's stringent conservation, that you're regulating a whole battery of downstream genes.
It's another program, I think. It doesn't mean.
No, but that's the way it's been interpreted.
Maybe, but.
It was interpreted to suggest homology of the vertebrate and invertebrate eye. And that would have been more compelling if you could demonstrate that the mammalian PAX6 directly regulated 100 target genes that are coordinated in the morphogenesis of the eye. And Bill is very clearly arguing, okay, if you do turn on one or two of the genes.
Sure,
they use it as an evolution. They use it as a homology.
No, I agree, but I think it's not what he's trying to argue. He's trying to argue for the conservation of the protein sequence. I think this stuff means that the protein is indeed conserved from fly to mammals, because it's able to turn on the same target. And I don't see more than that. It doesn't, I mean, maybe
I would say they're well enough conserved to regulate one or two of the same targets in a fly, yeah.
What?
No? Right. But I would argue that's not been the conventional interpretation. Maybe that's been your interpretation, but what's been written about in the literature has been that you're maintaining it, you're regulating a large set of a battery of downstream genes. This is an inference that's been drawn, and I would say that's not required. That's all.
I think you mix two questions. The question is how does gene regulate one or few targets, or do they regulate many targets?
Uh-huh.
But I think you phrased it by saying, do Hoxgene add Hoxgene conserve? And I think the answer is that yes, Hoxgene are conserved.
Yeah, they're conserved. Of course they're conserved.
The only answer is to say that Hoxgene are conserved, but they might regulate only few targets.
Yeah, but the question is, are they conserved for what? Of course they're conserved. Their functions are generally conserved. They're involved in AP patterning. But
they bind the same target.
They bind to, I'm sure, many of the same targets.
I think we must... You're not making progress.
No, we're not. Yes?
The point is simply somehow that this mammalian gene, which also is turned on in the patterning of the eye in vertebrates,
yeah,
happens to be in a similar pattern pathway in invertebrates.
It is.
Say anything that the downstream products are.
Doesn't. Right, right.
But there could be equivalent batteries downstream of the downstream.
Absolutely, could be. But there, what's happening is those batteries are being regulated by the endogenous fly protein. So it's not terribly surprising you would regulate the whole battery. That's what I would argue, Richard.
It seems to me that my problem is you don't know how many targets any one of these genes have to begin with. So I don't know
if you don't
want
it. It is a complete rescue. That's exactly right. In a certain cell at a certain time, it could be that all Eyeless has to do in that certain cell at a certain time is regulate one target. And there's some evidence, as you know, for that.
There would be a cascade for that.
Cascade in that tissue, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is the degree of conservation of that receptor the same quality as for the hot genes in the cross waters?
Yeah, it's similar, yeah.
So the cassette, the module?
The module, this module is conserved. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about some experiments we did, and I'm going to make it quick on the evolution of Hox protein function. So we were interested in looking at this divergence between multi-limb crustaceans and insects. There's strong molecular evidence that that insects really are just versions of crustaceans that crawled up on land and lost their abdominal limbs, their posterior limbs, about 400 million years ago, 350 million years ago. And so we wanted to study this transition because it had already been studied to some extent. So what are the possibilities of mutations in the Hox system that could contribute to limb loss? Well, you could lose the upstream limb activator gene expression for wingless or DPP or some of the other molecules that are required to activate the limb primordia, distalis and limb primordia. You could lose them from a certain region of the animal. You could gain Hox repressor binding sites in the distalis gene. So if distalis is expressed in all these guys and you have a Hox protein expressed in these segments that doesn't regulate distalis, you could change the regulatory element for distalis so it now has Hox binding sites and shut off distalis and remove limbs, probably other genes as well. You could have a Hox gene expressed way back here that was a limb repressor, and you could say, well, that Hox gene has mutations in its regulatory element. It spreads up through the proto-abdomen and gives you this morphology, this insect-like morphology, hexapod morphology. You could actually mutate the protein, so the Hox protein could already be expressed here, and you could change its function from neutral with respect to limb loss to a repressor. Or you could mutate Hox cofactor function or expression pattern or downstream gene elements or downstream gene function. So there's a lot of possibilities. We got lucky when we tried this experiment. We, and I'm not going to claim that we found the secret, the complete answer, but found something that contributes to this change. So the organisms we studied were Artemia franciscana and Drosophila. Artemia has 11 pairs of limbs. And it's believed by some questionable phylogenetic analyses that an organism similar to Artemia was related to the proto-insect just from molecular comparisons. What's an Artemia? It's a brine shrimp, and it lives in salty water, and it's a crustacean. You know,
sea monkeys.
You can get them in every store. You know. We get them in in coffee cans, which have, you know, a few million Artemia.
What do you feed Hydra with?
You feed Hydra with, and many different organisms. Very popular food source. Anyway, some important experiments had been done before we started ours, and that was Averroff and Akam had shown that the regulatory change had to be at the level of the Hox proteins or downstream when explaining this transition between multi-limbed crustacean and three-limbed insects, in that they had shown that UBX and abdominal A, these proteins that are limb repressors in flies, were expressed in the trunk, both UBX and abdominal A, in the limb primordia, and in those cells didn't repress the development of these limbs. So that put the change at the level of the Hox proteins or downstream. So a student in my lab, Matt Ronshagen, cloned out the Artemia ultrabithorax cDNA and found the protein sequence. And it's a lot different. It's 400 million years diverged from flies. It's a much shorter protein, 284 amino acids instead of 388. Overall, the match is 123 out of 388, so 32% sequence identity. Only one change in the homeodomain region, this DNA binding region, which also is a protein-protein interaction domain. And Matt put that into fruit fly embryos, turned it on in the thorax. So here's normal UBX abdominal A expression. And this is where the thorax is, and you can turn on Artemia versions of UBX, Drosophila versions of UBX, and test in that region whether they can repress limbs. The toughest thing for us in doing these experiments, and what we've spent actually by far the most time, is trying to find strains where you get similar levels within 10 to 20% of the levels of Drosophila UBX that are found in the normal first abdominal segment. So in our hands, when we've made these constructs that ectopically express in the thorax, for different protein isoforms, different hybrid proteins, you can have differences of much of 30-fold in the amount of expression you get from a single driver. And so you have to search through many strains, you have to try different conditions in order to get the same amount in those thoracic cells that are going to develop limbs as is normally found for UBX in the first abdominal segment. Sometimes it takes us months to get one strain, a particular strain that we want, to give the right amount of expression, which is a gigantic pain, but I would argue you can't really conclude much quantitatively about the function of these proteins until you do these kinds of experiments. You put it under the control of different promoters. So you have a so-called Gal4 UAS system. You attach a promoter that's expressed in the thorax or ubiquitously to yeast, the coding region for a yeast regulatory protein, Gal4, and that gets expressed everywhere. And then you have another insert in your genome where you've got Artemia UBX or whatever protein you want to express attached to the Gal4 binding sites, and that turns on that gene elsewhere in the embryo.
So why the variation?
Why the variation? Because of insertion sites of the inserts where you've got your UAS, your Gal4 binding sites next to your gene. I don't know what the rest of the variation is explained for. Some of it's explained by the fact you're expressing different proteins and different protein versions. So, yeah. Usually nothing. You can go up to fourfold, sometimes eightfold, and have very minor effects. So I worry more about lower levels of expression. If you're going to try to conclude that a certain protein has no function or has reduced function in a certain aspect, and you're only making 20% of the normal levels, you have to definitely take that into account. And if you do overexpress them, you do see effects on certain genes. There's no doubt about it, you know, stronger effects on certain genes. Anyway, so the conclusion is Drosophila UBX represses limbs and represses this distalous limb enhancer. So this 877 nucleotide represses the expression of this limb enhancer from the distalous locus. Artemia represses it slightly, but has much less of a regulatory effect. Whereas in the same cells, the Artemia protein isn't dead, it hasn't lost its function, because in the same cells in the ventral thorax, either the Drosophila protein or the Artemia protein can repress the transcription of Antennapedia, which is another protein that, another gene that UBX gene down-regulates. So there's one distinction, so there's some selectivity in where this Artemia protein is not repressing some Drosophila genes, but able to repress other genes. So we've looked at some other Drosophila genes that are known to be downstream targets of Drosophila UBX. One is DPP. So DPP is this TGF-beta-like gene, which is expressed at this stage in development in the visceral mesoderm. So this is a small slice of mesoderm cells. And when you turn on Drosophila UBX in this region more anterior in the visceral mesoderm, you expand the expression pattern of DPP to include most of the visceral mesoderm. If you try the same experiment with Artemia UBX, you get expression in more anterior regions, indicating you can regulate DPP in those other cells, but it's a striped expression pattern. And that those stripes where Artenopedia, that's where Artemia UBX doesn't activate, are dependent on some sequences at the C-terminus. So if you delete sequences at the C-terminus, including some serines and threonines, which I'll talk about more later, you get a protein that activates DPP much like Drosophila UBX. And another set of targets, at least another effect on morphology, that where Artemia UBX mimics Drosophila UBX is if you express it in the wing. So this is a wing, a backwards wing. And if you express Drosophila UBX, you repress wing development by regulating many downstream genes that a few labs have worked on. If you misexpress Artemia UBX, same driver, you also repress wing development. So certainly it has a lot of function, but it has very little function in repression of UBX, of distalis and limb development embryos. So Matt tried to figure out where the important parts of the protein was that differed between the Drosophila protein and the Artemia protein, and typically what you do is make a bunch of chimeric proteins trading different regions back and forth to find out where the important sequences are. And he found the important sequences were in the C-terminus of the protein. So if you took the Drosophila protein, 300 and some amino acids, and attached about, or substituted about 30 amino acids from the Artemia version of UBX, you now had a protein that very poorly repressed limbs, was essentially not a limb repressor, whereas if you took the Artemia protein, which normally didn't repress limbs or had 15% limb repression, and put on a few amino acids, a couple dozen amino acids from the Drosophila protein, you now had a very good limb repressor. One possibility, of course, is there's a limb repression function, a new repression function that's evolved in the insect protein that's not in the crustacean protein.
Bill, did you have to both remove
all you have to do is remove the Artemia peptide? So initially we thought that you had this novel repression domain that was found in Drosophila, and as Mike was saying, so we did some other experiments where we just removed the Artemia C-terminus. That creates a powerful limb repressor. And in fact, when you remove the C-terminus from the Drosophila protein, or most of the C-terminus, you still have limb repression function. So it looks like there's the limb repression ability of Drosophila UBX is permissive for the C-terminus. The C-terminal sequence are permissive. But for Artemia, there's a region normally down here in the C-terminus that interferes with the ability of the Artemia protein to repress limbs. So Matt sequenced, did the usual Evo-Devo thing, where he sequenced the C-terminal regions of UBX proteins, and there was some of these sequenced already from a lot of insects and a lot of multi-limbed arthropods and other arthropods, and found out that there was in only one of the insects, a basal insect, was there a serine residue in the C-terminus, whereas all these others had multiple serine and threonine residues. And this reminded us of an experiment that Richard Mann had done, who's in the audience here. You could, yes. Did you notice some other sequence?
It's just that something paradoxical, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
So these cases that you're discussing, UBX is expressed in a domain where limbs form.
Yes.
Saying that the serine-rich C-terminal peptide prevents UBX from interfering with distal.
Right.
But on the contrary, if I remember correctly, that's not true.
Yeah, I'm going to go into that.
Okay. Thank you.
So one possibility, anyway, this reminded us of some experiments that Jaffe and Mann had done a few years before, where they'd taken Drosophila antennapedia, which normally doesn't repress limbs, and what they'd done is mutate, they found CK2 as a protein that interacted with Drosophila antennapedia, and they mutated the four CK2 sites, and they found that now this version of antennapedia with four serines and threonines changed now could repress Distalis, indicating that even in the Drosophila antennapedia protein, those serines and threonines were inhibiting a limb repression ability of a Hox protein. So Matt then mutated various combinations of the serines and threonines in the C-terminus of the Artemia protein, and when he mutated six out of the seven serines and threonines, he got an Artemia version that was mutated toward a insect hexapod UBX function in the sense that you got 75% of limb repression, greatly increased its ability to repress limbs.
These are all alanine substitutions?
These are all alanine substitutions.
Could that have created a fortuitous repression domain?
It could be. At least that could be part of the reason why it works. We've changed it to some other amino acids, but we don't have enough, there's not enough hard data to say how much that affects it. So the other experiments that were done that were very similar were from Sean Carroll's lab. They worked on the function of onychophoran UBX. This is an onychophoran. It's a pre-arthropod with limbs on every body segments. It lives in tropical regions and a sister group to the arthropods. Yeah, I wouldn't say pre-arthropod, really. Some people would argue that, but very ancient organisms. Supposedly you can find fossils of them in the Cambrian, pre-Cambrian strata. And in onychophorans, ultrabithorax, the UBX gene is expressed only in this posterior-most segment, but it is expressed in the segment that has an appendage growing out of it. And Gallant and Carroll had a paper that accompanied ours where they showed that if you took onychophorin UBX, it didn't repress limbs. But if you took onychophorin UBX and attached the C-terminus of Drosophila UBX, you got a very good limb repressor. And if you deleted the C-terminus of onychophorin, but still left a threonine residue there that's conserved in antennapedia and some other proteins, you didn't have a limb repressor function. So they concluded that this antennapedia, and I think there's a good reason to think this is part of the answer, that Drosophila UBX, since its divergence from onychophorans over the past 600 million years or so, has evolved a limb repressor function. There is some limb repression ability in this C-terminal sequences. And as evidence for that, we made a protein version of the protein, quantitated its levels, and found that if you delete the conserved region found in insects from this protein, it's still a reasonably good limb repressor, but not as good as full-length Drosophila UBX. So there's some evidence, I think, to positive and negative evidence to support the idea that Drosophila UBX has evolved some limb repression function there. Anyway, so the summary of this is that transition 400 million years ago or so between a multi-limb crustacean, one of the things that happened that was very important to getting the hexapod body plan repressing limbs in the abdomen was that you changed, mutated some serines and threonines in the C-terminal region to glutamines and alanines and other amino acids. But anyway, you lost some CK2 sites and other potential phosphorylation sites, and that removed limbs from the body plan. So we argued that this is a so-called explanation at the molecular level for a macro evolutionary transition, a big change in the body plan. Don't know what this domain is interacting with. I'll tell you about that in just a second, but some biochemistry. So here's a cartoon of macroevolution versus microevolution, and Darwin talked a lot about microevolution, strongly thought that there would be very gradual steps toward big evolutionary changes. Our experiments really don't strongly address this because we can't look at what the transitional organisms are like, but it does suggest that only a few small changes could make a big difference in the function of a regulatory protein that might have some selective value and removing limbs. Nobody really knows, or even there's not been much speculation about why, what would be the selective advantage of removing abdominal limbs from a crustacean that's crawling up on land and trying to do a terrestrial existence. There's a lot of speculation, but it's kind of useless.
Can you go back for 1 second?
Yes.
The
honor?
Sorry. Yeah, okay. So you change, but hold on, the UVX is still being expressed.
Yeah, so Averroff and Akin had shown, well, you have to do two things. You have to change the expression pattern of UVX, so it's now on only in the proto-abdomen.
Okay.
And you have to, I would argue, change these amino acids. And probably 10 other things. But
if you change the pattern of expression, then you don't have...
You can change the pattern of expression without repressing limbs, because the crustacean ancestor doesn't have any repressive effect on limbs.
So what is the meaning of it having evolved a repression, an inhibitor of its repression function when the ancestor does not express UVX where limbs are formed?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't really have a good answer to it. Why would you have this inhibitory domain on some kind of function? Yeah,
and
it's repressing other genes. It's presumably a regulatory step.
In other words, that slide should say crystallis repression function or some other gene repression function.
Well, a function required for the repression of distalis.
Rather than
lipid. Yes.
Because UVX is not.
Yeah, I would. There's some evidence that it's not just distalis, but I would agree it's a selective function.
It's now a conditional repressor.
Conditional repressor, right?
Thank you, sir.
Anyway, so we argued that this has some advantages, this kind of mutation, because in evolution, because it's dominant, so you don't need to fix recessive mutations. Many population geneticists hate this paper and have argued vehemently that there's no way that this could possibly be part of the mechanism, because evolution has to occur, big jumps in evolution have to occur by 50 genes changing simultaneously in interesting patterns in order to get something, but all I can do is point at the evidence. And there are some advantages. That is, if there's some selective value to repression of limbs, reduction in limb size, these kind of mutations will be dominant, so you don't have to fix recessive mutations in a population. And it could be that the number of serine threonine residues might allow, you know, micro evolutionary steps toward a big change. So that's the idea, and we're testing all those things to the extent that we can. Also, since it is serine threonine residues and basically casein kinase 2 and GSK3 consensus sites, so this any novel variation or what you've got is a regulated inhibitor of repression, and so you could tune the amount of repression you get during evolution by cell signaling pathways. So could this be a common way? Is there kind of some kind of developmental constraints that makes this a common way for limb loss to occur in arthropods? And there's one paper that addresses this to some extent. So in Daphnia, another crustacean, they have strikingly different limb morphologies on their thorax, if you will. In the first segment, they have a relatively small appendage, and they have bigger appendages on the second segment and much bigger and more complicated appendage on the third. And this is prefigured by the expression pattern of distalis. So this is Shiga and collaborators from Hayashi's lab. I looked at distalis expression and found that in the first thoracic segment, you don't see the patch of distalis expression, this limb promoting or body outgrowth promoting gene, that you do in the rest of the thoracic segment. And what they also found is that this corresponds to a region where the Daphnia antennapedia protein is expressed at high levels. And so then they took the antennapedia, so they hypothesized that the antennapedia protein in Daphnia might have some limb repression function and might explain this difference in limb morphology. So they took the Daphnia antennapedia protein and expressed it in flies, and the normal Daphnia antennapedia protein doesn't have any good consensus casein kinase 2 sites. And they found that when we put it in flies, it did repress limbs in this assay where you look at the expression of thoracic limbs. When they added some casein kinase 2 sites to the C-terminus, it's still repressed, but it looked like it was a weaker repressor of limb development. So again, there's this correlation between some particular type of phosphorylation sites and the ability to repress distalis and limb. So it might be a fair, and we're testing this in some other lineages to see whether spider limb removal is conferred by mutations in some of the spider Hox proteins and so forth. Now, if they'd really read Richard Mann's paper very carefully, they would have added some more casein kinase 2 sites and maybe got a better result, but I don't know why they didn't. You talk to them, Richard? I mean, you want. So what biochemical properties are being altered in the artemia protein by these serine threonine residues? So really the only kind of test we've done is to put phosphates on the CK2 site of artemia and see what that does to DNA binding ability. There is a dramatic difference between the CK2 phosphorylability of the artemia protein, the artemia UBX protein, so this is the incorporation of hot P32 onto this serine in the C-terminus of the artemia protein. Whereas Drosophila UBX, a comparable amount of Drosophila UBX, doesn't get phosphorylated by casein kinase 2. And so far, with a great variety of different kinds of mutations in the C-terminus, we have a perfect correlation between the amount that the protein gets phosphorylated in vitro by CK2 and its ability to repress. So if you don't have much CK2 phosphorylation in vitro, you get a good repressor in vivo, vice versa. So the experiment we've done in vitro, another in vitro experiment, is to take the artemia protein, and this copies some experiments that Richard did with the antennapedia protein, where they changed some of the serines and threonines and CK2 sites to glutamic residues. Anyway, so this is the important CK2 site. If you put a phosphate on there and test the ability of this DNA binding protein's ability to bind to the distalis BX1 element, which is one of those UBX binding site in that distalis enhancer, what you see is that you remove its ability to bind as a monomer, although it still has almost its entire ability to bind as a dimer to this BX1 site. And so our interpretation of this, so here's the phosphorylated form binding to DNA, here's the unphosphorylated form at that single CK2 site, is that the phosphorylated form can bind as a dimer, actually the unphosphorylated form can bind as a dimer and a monomer to this BX1 sequence, but the phosphorylated monomer, when you phosphorylate UBX and test for its ability to bind this as a monomer, it doesn't bind very well at all. So we don't think that it entirely explains the difference in repression or not repression ability, but it's probably part of the answer.
When you study,
yeah, so we've checked to look at the amount of proteins. We get the amount of protein the same. We check to make sure that all the proteins we express are concentrated in the nucleus. And there are some versions that we've made that aren't concentrated in the nucleus, and we haven't reported those. We don't work with those because we don't understand what's happening in that case. But the only ones that we've looked, we haven't seen any difference in the phosphate modification, ability of the protein to be modified, and its transport into the nucleus. I'm going to skip some stuff here, if I can go in the right direction. I just want to tell you about one thing that's, there's other examples of Hox proteins evolving new function, actually dramatically evolving new function. I just want to tell you about one new technique that we're working on in my lab and Ethan Beer's lab. So a couple years ago, Ethan Beer and I wrote this grant to improve multiplex in situ hybridization to embryos. So. And this work has almost entirely depended on Dave Kossman, who was a researcher in John Reinitz's lab, and maybe one of the best in situ hybridizers in the entire planet. He started out as a undergraduate in Mike Levine's lab, had a science paper. He's never gotten a PhD, but he's just devoted to in situ hybridization and its improvement. He loves it. The good old days.
When science was a more agreeable culture.
Anyway, so we started out with the standard stuff, just trying to improve trying to prove the current methods, and so Dave was able to get a world record at the moment of looking at different gene expression patterns. This is the expression pattern of four genes on the Drosophila dorsal ventral axis.
On the same embryo.
On the same embryo, just looking looking at different channels, different emission spectra.
Do you have an idea of what the sensitivity is compared to RNA and sequencing? Compared to the GU normal? This is fluorescence, right?
This is fluorescence, yeah.
Compared to color?
I don't really know. Don't really know the difference. Difference in sensitivity. Yeah. Dave's actually gotten direct labeled probes, so one of the ways that he's been able to get this to work, it's not shown in this slide, is from molecular probes you can make your probe and then you can chemically modify your RNA probe with fluorescence adducts, and he's been able to detect signals from many transcripts with these direct labeled probes, so that you don't have to do an antibody sandwich to put the fluorochrome onto the probe. We don't really know how many molecules per cell. These are fairly abundant transcripts that we've been able to detect with that method. With the new quantum dots, I think we'll be able to detect almost anything. If you can get quantum dots onto RNA, because these quantum dots are these, they're fluorophores that you can shine, I don't understand it terribly well. Some of the physicists can explain it, but there's some kind of resonance inside these little semiconductor dots or something, tiny little dots, and you get emission at different wavelengths, very sharply tuned wavelengths. That's about 10 times stronger than your average fluorochrome. So you can buy them now from the Quantum Dot Corporation. They have a strep-abdin conjugate. But it should make it much, much easier once this is in widespread use.
Can you couple those to antibodies?
Or yeah, couple them to antibodies. Right. Yeah. Or strep-abdin.
Is this method available, or are you just bragging about it?
No, the method's available. This is not the interesting part, actually, I would argue. So here's the interesting part. So this is based really on some experiments that were published this year by Robert Singer at Albert Einstein, but Dave has adapted these to use in the Drosophila embryo, which is to look at nascent transcripts. So we've been calling this nascent transcript multiplex fluorescent in situ hybridization, or nascent transcript MFISH. So we've done this with a number of genes, but I'm going to show you the best example, which has been done with the VMD gene of Drosophila, which is expressed in the lateral parts of the Drosophila embryo, SOG gene, which is expressed also in the same region, and rhomboid also expressed in the same region. Anyway, in a male, which has only one X chromosome, we know the locations of these genes. Here's where SOG is, here's where VND is, and there should be two copies, two transcription units with that are expressing VND. Anyway, when you look at an actual nucleus in these regions, or a field of nuclei in these regions, and this is actually a flattened stack of images. In this particular nucleus, for example, you can see that's the nascent transcripts attached to the chromosome for VND. There's the nascent transcripts attached to the chromosome for SOG and the nascent transcripts for rhomboid. And this works with amazing efficiency. Dave thinks that he's getting, well above 90% of each nucleus that's expressing the gene, that you can see by cytoplasmic accumulation of transcripts. You can see the nascent transcript signal, so-called nuclear dots.
Why isn't the message in the cytoplasm
light up here? Because it's much more diffuse. It turns out if you actually look very carefully with a very good confocal, and this depends on a very, very good confocal to get these kinds of images, the cytoplasmic signal is so diffuse you can turn the you can turn the gain. So basically all you see is the nascent transcripts. If you turn the gain up, you'd see the cytoplasmic transcripts. Yeah, we don't really know how many transcripts are on each locus. How many? Some are big, some are small. It's interesting, we actually have to use 3' probes for this, because if you look at a really big gene, a 5' probe from a really big gene like Homothorax or Tenopedia, what you see is a smear, little dots that go almost through 1/4 of the nucleus, which may tell you some very interesting things, but for our purposes, just looking at where gene, what combination of genes are expressed in a certain region, it's not terribly useful. Oh yeah, so this is a depiction of what we're actually seeing in this nucleus. So this is a nucleus of a blastoderm embryo where these three genes are all being expressed. So this is the X chromosome, and there are transcripts being produced from this region of the X chromosome from this gene, the SOG gene. There are RNA transcripts being produced from the VND gene at this place on the X chromosome, which is right there. And on the third chromosome, there's on the third homologs, third chromosome homologs, there's two dots, two green dots, which represent nascent transcripts, transcripts still attached to the chromosome for rhomboid. Those are the centromeres of the chromosome. So in many Drosophila cells, you have this kind of, roughly this kind of organization. Yeah.
Hey, the distance between the yellow and the red thing, what kind of resolution can you possibly get?
Yeah, well, the resolution of light microscope is 200 nanometers, and we haven't tried, we've tried genes, I think, that are about 200 kilobases apart, and you can see them resolved by this method. So. Anyway, so the interesting thing about this, this is kind of cool, but the interesting thing about this is by just having you know, a reasonable number of probe colors, you can build up gene expression patterns, look at different genes combinatorially. So for example, with three probe colors, we've done this for the limb field. We're interested mostly in doing this in the limb field of an early Drosophila embryo and the surrounding cells to try to learn what it takes to make a limb field and what it takes to repress a limb field. You can, with three probe colors, you can look at seven genes, with four probe colors, 15, 5, 31, and six probe colors, 63. It should be relatively easy to make the probes. We don't know exactly, we're up to six genes. We've done six genes so far with this combinatorial scheme, including most of these genes. And so we, but we think, Dave thinks at least, that he'll pretty easily be able to get up to 31 genes simultaneously looking at their nascent transcripts in nuclei, in Drosophila nuclei, which, you know, we've been thinking of various names for this. So one of them is 3D nuclear nanoarrays. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we think this is going to be very useful. We've already put some of the information about this on a UCSD website, and you know, we're going to try to let people use this as much as possible, because we think you will be able to accumulate in given nuclei. You'll be able to learn a lot, I think, from looking at nascent transcripts, patterns, stochastic patterns of gene expression and so forth. It's going to give a really lot of new kinds of information that'll be useful for computational approaches to looking at gene expression regulation and so forth. And, you know, the possibility is that, you know, if you can do 31 genes at a time, you can pretty quickly go through, you know, all of the genes are expressed in patterns in an early Drosophila embryo or in the limb field and so forth, and get a really kind of a holistic idea about where they're at. Yeah.
Colors, 6 genes or 7 genes?
7, actually. 7 genes. So it's 2 to the n minus 1. That's how many you can look at. Okay. 1 is colored by 3, so.
Y minus 1, why don't you also use white? I mean, red, blue, and green?
We do. Yeah, no, it's still 2 to the n minus 1. So it's a binomial expansion, and you lose 1 because of some reason. I don't know. Yeah, no gene, exactly. Yeah. There is a no gene signal, but.
So you have to find something else in color, though.
Yes, yes. Our no gene is actually, you do have to do a nuclear stain simultaneously so you can see exact outlines of the nucleus so you can tell exactly where you're at. Eventually, you know, we got a bioinformatics student who's writing programs so that, because you do have to use the three-dimensional information in the nucleus so that you can get all the information from each of the genes, you know, because each one is a little you know, a few voxels in space where you have a certain emission spectrum coming out, and you know, turn that information essentially into gene expression patterns that you can superimpose on embryos. And anyway, so that's
sort of an extreme point of view that when a gene is selected for activation, it's moved to one part of the nuclear compartment, and when the gene is silenced, it's shut into a different part.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have any sense?
We've seen absolutely no evidence for that in these blastoderm or in limb fields for any of that. So,
but not even sort of periphery with the center or anything like that.
No, if you do a 3D stack, you can see, you know, at least for the genes that we've looked at, which is a dozen, we don't see any localization of any overlap of those genes that are on different sites on the chromosome. Mm-hmm. So if you look at two genes that are adjacent 20 kb away, actually sometimes you can see, you know, a slight resolution, sometimes you can't. So yeah. Yeah, we don't really know. We think that someday we'll be able to say something about relative levels of RNA relative to a standard in the nucleus. Whether we'll ever get to say, you know, this is we're detecting 5 transcripts on this locus or not, we don't really know yet at the moment. So,
John has to revisit all these images.
What?
John Reinitz has to revisit all these images.
John is going to have to redo everything. He doesn't realize it.
You shouldn't have let Kosman do your lab.
But he let Kosman go, and it's just going to cause him problems. No, it's a different kind of information. John's been looking at steady state. This is looking at nascent transcripts, and I don't expect that you'll get exactly the same answer. So, because the messages and proteins are going to have different half-lives and so forth. So
what do you think? There's maybe 10 nascent transcripts on a locus at any given
moment? We can detect, Dave can detect, I will say this, Dave can detect single transcripts by this argument in the cytoplasm. That if you use a probe against one part of the transcript and another part of the transcript, and then you look at 100 of them, 100 of the signals, you see that you always see the two emission spectra adjacent or overlapping in the cytoplasmic signals.
You may theoretically have single transcript resolution, but I don't know if you need it.
I don't think we.
Polymerase probably loads.
Yeah. Yeah, we may actually be able to say something about that eventually with this method, so.
Have you finished the presentation?
I'm done.
Well, first of all, let's do it. Okay. I'm just going to put on the lights. Please, please ask quick.
Yeah. What is stringent functional conservation?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the most stringent functional conservation would be if you took, the Antennapedia protein from mammals and put it in place of the Drosophila Antennapedia protein. And even though they've diverged by, and only share about 20% amino acid identity, if when you did that gene replacement, if the mammal gene could completely rescue every known function of Antennapedia, particularly the morphological functions, you'd say that was extraordinary stringent conservation throughout the life cycle. You got a live fly behave normally, all this stuff. That experiment hasn't been done for any of these gene swaps. So
that protein is similar to the functions in the homologous gene.
That would say it functions in the same gene network.
Exactly the same way.
Exactly the same way. That's not what you get for these. My point is that's not what you get, not even close to that, for these long-distance gene swaps. Yeah.
I still remain shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I'm traumatized to be blunt. that it's the Hox gene that has changed the protein.
Yeah.
Rather than the Dunst gene type. Because I always had the impression that Hox genes had an enormous effect when you change.
Right.
And therefore you would have thought that if you want to evolve, what you would want to do is to change the downstream type.
Right.
And you're telling me.
Well, you do both. I'm sure that there's a lot of downstream targets that are changing, but one of the ways that evolution can, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
What was the phenotype of the flies you were expecting the VX of the abdomen?
The phenotype of the adult flies, they're wingless and they're extremely, well, if you express it in the wing, if you express it everywhere during the period when, you have a marginal disc, you're going to give rise to the adult fly, the fly is dead with many malformations when you ectopically express the... No. Yeah.
There are experiments on Carol's lab comparing the impression of UBX between fly and Voltaire, which show that UBX hits also a lot of downstream
mm-hmm.
targets within the Voltaire
mm-hmm.
region. You see the same thing for the source that also hits a lot of downstream genes that are well down the hierarchy?
We don't really know. That's one of the reasons why we're doing this nascent transcript in situ stuff, is so we can look at a lot of targets and look at a lot of targets, potential targets of distal simultaneously. So it really hasn't been done in the embryonic limb field. There's a lot more been done in adult limb, patterning what genes are required and some of the downstream genes, but not so much in embryos.
Do you know what's happening in butterflies when you have the larval legs but not the adult legs? Mm-hmm. What is changing between the larva and the adult?
It could be the expression pattern of UBX, but nobody's really looked at that. I mean, the experiment we have to do is to put the insect UBX into a crustacean, a developing crustacean, see whether it's sufficient to repress limbs. And we're doing that in collaboration with Nipon Patel, but technically it's quite complicated, so we haven't gotten any results yet, or interpretable results.
I think we should break for coffee. Back at 11, please. Sharper than usual.